Do not forget that a man will chain his fellows with the fetters of oppression, he warned. That he will brandish naked steel to enforce his will. He will use the whip to enslave those less powerful. In defense of his decision, God argued that he had placed within man a spark of his own divinity. And that when man learned to fan this spark into a flame, he would have the capacity to confound the dire prophecies of truth. We have within us energies equal to or greater than those of the atom. We only allow them to become dominant in our lives. There's nothing inevitable about war or about the separations of class, caste, and race with which men disturb their lives. Man can overcome these if he will, but use the God-implanted energy within to direct his life in useful ways. In those fiery crucibles, the fabric of the atom could be disintegrated, if Adam's energies let loose. We cannot create a human crucible, yet I wonder if Rosh Hashanah is not in its own way a giant spiritual reactor. The mood, the music, the stock-taking, the prayer, the concept of a day set aside from our usual business routine somehow fan these flames of the divine within us and afford us a sense of the spiritual greatness which we can assume. The youngster once captured for me the spirit of Rosh Hashanah when she said, on the new year, I am not myself. I sense within me powers I'm usually unaware of. I am not myself, I'm the person I ought to be. Grammar of Rosh Hashanah is simple. It's stated in the first person singular. I am, I can be, I ought to be, I will be. Rosh Hashanah can set a mood and provide a context, but you must provide the specifics. Rosh Hashanah displays a simple message. You have within you, each of us carries within a capacity for moral courage, for love, for virtue, and for goodness, which we have not fully developed. We may not even be conscious of these capacities. It is strange what a lowest estimate we are prepared to make of ourselves, because we desire to protect our egos, our vanities, and our pretensions. We act ignobly because we argue the world is an evil and a wicked place. When I heard men say, when I'm in business, I cannot always walk a straight path. I must be callous in my dealings with employers and competitors, because business is a dog-eat-dog enterprise. I must be concerned with my survival, with my well-being, and with that of my family. Such rationalization implies two things. First, awareness that if life were somehow different, we would be better people. And that the way we act is to compromise what we know to be right with the person we might be. Secondly, we can justify these compromises by a harsh judgment about the world we live in. Are these assumptions justified? I wonder. If we look clearly at the business world, we will find many open-handed, open-hearted business people. Men and women of the highest probity, whose word is their bond. For every man who cuts corners or sets self-interest above honor, there are hundreds who will not. Think of those whom you have heard justify niggardly gifts on the ground that their friends give similar gifts. I wonder how we conceive that all of our institutions of learning and healing are financed or sponsored. Have we forgotten the hundreds who give largely and sacrificially of time and of self? So are those who say, I pay my taxes, I'm a law-abiding citizen, I have done my share, and that's enough. Then I want to work in any of your institutions or any of your boards. I will not do more than my share. Well, someone is staffing and supporting and volunteering in these institutions. People give of their time, their energies, their talents, that this community and every community can be a fine, healthy society. Now, we cannot justify a low estimate of ourselves by a low estimate of our neighbors. We have only to look about us, the circle of our friends and our families. We will find goodness shining from many faces. We ought not allow our desire to justify weakness to lead us to set a low standard for our conduct. It simply isn't so. There are other causes for our low estimate of ourselves. One is a half knowledge of philosophy and of psychology. That man is by nature selfish and cannot be trusted. He has never seen a single act of disinterested goodness. That what passes for virtue is simply a cunning disguise by which the more able hide their self-serving. That's the conventional wisdom. I wonder, may I revert to the simile of the atom with which we began? I have never seen disembodied virtue, or goodness, or sympathy, or compassion in the abstract. No one has. But then I have never seen the subatomic particles of energy whose discovery brought us into the atomic age. No one has seen them. We know them only through their activity. Most cunningly contrived microscope cannot bring electrons, neutrons, and protons into our field of sight. We cannot see virtue in the abstract, but we see it in action. We see it in the mother caring for her infant. We see it in the father training up his child in the way that he should go. We see it in the minister making calls on his parish, the doctor making hospital rounds, the teacher in the classroom. We see it in friends who are sympathetic and solicitous of our joys and grief. We see it in the invalid, whose lips are sealed against expressing pain, lest it burden another. We see it in the youth, determined to fulfill their talents, but means putting off today's pleasures for more years of training. But remember, the argument that man is only an animal had two parts. None that human virtue does not exist in the abstract, but that what passes for virtue is really a travesty of virtue. No one can deny that charity is sometimes given a desire for public acclaim or approval. We cannot deny that sympathy is sometimes an expression of guilt, nor that some are calculating in their virtue. And yet, let us for the moment look not without but within, not at another's actions, but at our own. Let us admit that we cannot be calculating in our kindnesses, but also that we have moments of instinctive, impulsive sympathy. There have been times when we have given of ourselves without thought, without premeditation, simply because we felt another's hurt or rejoiced in another's happiness. The best of our actions are not calculated nor premeditated, but are instinctively an upwelling of the spiritual power within us. We ought to think more highly of ourselves. We ought to realize we have an obstinate capacity for goodness, even for saintliness. However hard we work at perfecting our character, we all have within us untapped reservoirs of spiritual energy. Some have told me, I wish your assessment were true. I wish that most people, most of the time, were good people. In reading the daily papers and watching the news on television, this does not seem to be the case. Some quote the poet, hollow men tilling a spiritual wasteland, drained of moral energy, callous and self-seeking. Look, sensitive people say, look at the headlines. We work for peace, and yet we have war. We establish a world organization to bring the nations together in cooperative effort. Yet that institution must fight to become more than a propaganda sounding board. Look at the rulers of nations who trample on their people's necks. Look at our own country. The hatred, the bigotry, and the prejudice which are daily in evidence. Pick up a Cleveland newspaper. You will see the pathologically ill and the demented. A mother drugging her children. Young sadists murdering their drug competitors. How can you speak of the potential goodness of man? How can you speak optimistically of the future? I wonder if the newspapers give us a clear view of the world about us. They need sensation, shock, and a startling head turn. But for every sensational and shocking act, are there not hundreds of acts of simple goodness? Think of your own life. Think of other good people, thoughtful, considerate people who work diligently and honorably. You're surrounded by love, the love of your parents, the love of your children, the love of your family, the love of your friends. Doesn't this tell us something about the proportion of good and evil in our world? One can claim that we have met the challenge which the angel Truth set before us. Could we not describe the chronicle of heroism at least as significant as the chronicle of hollow men? I see in my mind's eye a surgeon volunteering his services in the jungles of Asia. I see a young black American silently marching past the jeers of white bigots to claim equal rights and opportunities. I see a young Israeli farmer scratching greenness out of barren desert under a burning, cruel sun to feed his people. I see so much of greatness in life, greatness in you, greatness in all of us. I emphasize the capacity in each of us, the counter to the despair and constriction in our lives. Many have given up the fight, retired into a protective cocoon of routine. They will not read the paper. It brings only nightmares and disturbs their sleep. They will not leave the narrow circle of friends and involve themselves in the community, because that will demand too much of them. Last year at a college graduation, perhaps in jest, but spoken nevertheless, the valedictory speech ended with these words. They say, let us live quietly. We are not bad people. The weight of the world is too much for us. Please, just leave me alone. No, we cannot and must not be left alone. We cannot allow the willful and the self-willed to control by default the machinery of civilization, to determine when and where poisons or bombs will spread annihilation and destroy our world. We cannot guarantee the world's peace and safety. This much can be guaranteed. But if we retreat within the doors of our homes, there will be disaster. We need men and women who will walk on the stage of the world, fight the just fight, preach the gospel of humanity. Brave the arrows aimed at them by selfish interests. We need to accept the simple truth that we are the makers of the future, that the future is in our hands. Where is the factory of peace? In nurseries, homes filled with love, shining with the example of good parents. That's where strong-hearted and strong-minded citizens are created. Where is our future? It is in the classroom, where we are equipped with knowledge, tools of learning here. The citizen is formed. Character is taught through every relationship in which we are involved. Every helpful action we take contributes to peace. Working with a neighbor, we help to destroy the prejudices which divide. By injecting fact into emotional dispute, we calm jangled nerves and encourage more mature judgment. We're the makers of the future, each in his own way, using his unique talents within his circle of daily associations. We think beyond our leisure and our luxuries. Each of us can be the maker of a grand future. We are not hollow men tilling a spiritual wasteland. Men and women filled with a divine spirit, filled with unbelievable spiritual energies, tilling the fields of peace and promise on this Rosh Hashanah. On the first birthday of the world, God placed before man a rich, beautiful world and said, this is your world and your challenge. Intellectually and scientifically, we have met a great part of that challenge. We have learned and are learning to respect nature. We have learned to control the spread of disease. We have learned how to provide food sufficient to the needs of the world. We have gained necessary insights into religion, philosophy, and law, which we need to regulate our activities. On this birthday of the world, we need faith, courage and the determination to apply our knowledge wisely. We must allow the spirit within to be fully expressed and use our God-given powers for God-stipulated purposes. Today we sense not only the person we have been and are, but the person that we ought to be. Today we examine not only the world that was and is, but the world that can be. If we are the people that we ought to be, surely the world will be the world which we know it can be. Amen. Alone is our King, as it is written, "Know then this day and take it to heart. The Lord is God in the heavens above and in the earth below, and there is none else. We therefore hope, O Lord our God, soon to behold the glory of your might.
Then will false gods vanish from our hearts, and the world will be perfected under your unchallenged rule. And then will all acclaim you as their God, and forsaking evil, turn to you alone. Let all who dwell on earth acknowledge that unto you every knee must bend, and every tongue swear loyalty. Before you, O Lord our God, let them humble themselves. To your glorious name, let them give honor. Let all accept the yoke of your kingdom, that you may rule over them soon and forever. For the kingdom is yours, and to all eternity you will reign in glory. As it is written, the Lord will reign forever and ever."
To those who have gone from life. Recall the joy of their companionship. We feel a pang, the echo of that intenser grief when first their death lay before our stricken eyes. Now we know that they will never vanish so long as heart and soul remain, thought remain within us. By love are they remembered, in memory they live. For God, grant that their memory may bring strength and blessing. May the ability of their lives and the high ideals they cherished endure in our thoughts, live on in our grief, in our deeds. May we, carrying on their voice, their work, help to redeem your promise that life shall not avail. We name then those who passed away this week. Milton D. Spiro, Elizabeth Wiseman, Sam Zip, Isidore Malkus. And we mark off this week also the interest of those whose yard site occurred. Rachel Leah Kindis, Louis Koblitz, Louis D. Goldhammer, Edwin R. Goodman, Moses S. Copperman, Lena Squires, Lucille K. Marks, Hannah Rice, Ann Polsky Finn, Francis L. Spiro, Leo Friedman, Jack B. Dworkin, Edward G. Spitz, Eva Trachner, Hannah Thurman, Dr. Leo Rich, Isidore Alexander, Edna L. Siegel, Fanning Farkas, Dr. Stanley H. Shensa, Suya Rose, Myrtle I. Cohn, Bertha Weil, Arnold J. Rose, Samuel Gerst, Bernard Benson, Max Samuels, Harry Hart, Virginia H. Heller, William Wiesenberg, Lulu I. Woodle, Molly Kaliski, Florence A. Wolfe,